everybody. Welcome to Things Are Looking Up, number 12. That's right, season one. It's the season finale. And I know it's January 2008, but for me, the new year really doesn't start till spring. Now maybe it's the ancient druids coming out in the Irish blood in me, I don't know. But there's something about winter that just says, lay low, take it easy, don't make waves, be laid back, just like this music. You may recall this from an earlier episode, I don't remember which one, and I'm not, honestly, gonna take the time to look it up. But the song is Saturday Morning by Anne Farnsworth. And it's Friday night, 8:50 Eastern Standard Time. Or is it Eastern Daylight Time? I don't really care. I'm trying to put on my best Bill Shatner for you. Not a whole lot coming in this episode. Got a couple things of feedback I wanted to hit on. A couple people I wanted to recognize. And I wanted to look back a little on 2007. Look forward to 2008. I think what I may do is play a little of that Nightwish for you. Just a little. Just a taste. Some of my favorite parts. And see what you think. So anyway, we will also have the second half of Larry Nemechek in this episode. Finally, even though the 12 Trek days of Christmas are long over, go back to episode 11. Check the show notes. I think there's a link. But I at least will make one for this episode. Want to thank all y'all who listen. From Toronto, Canada, all the way to the Bay, Wellington, New Zealand. Man, that's cool. I have a listener in Wellington, New Zealand. Pip Ballantyne is her name. She is the first Queen of Moravia on Moravia Remastered. Head over to Moravia, MoreVi.net. And I know, like, most of the people that listen to the show, like, listen to Moravia, you know, patio books and all that crap. Special thanks to Phil Rossi. I finally started listening to Crescent, and it is the awesome. And also Space Casey, spacecasey.com, you know, like space case with a Y at the end. Space Casey, Christiana Ellis. Like T. Morris says, she's the Neil Simon of podcasting. Girl can write the funny. Okay, I like to think I take a little bit from her. Because she is the awesome. Yeah, and she coined that, by the way, the awesome. And I am just the Indiana Jim. This has been, to steal a phrase, intro babble. So, suppose we should quit with the intro babble. And we should quit it right now. And that, as they say, is the end of the intro babble. So I got some feedback a while back. It's been forever. This came in November 13th, 2007. It's Brian from Jacksonville. Says he's a longtime listener. And I do remember Brian from very early on. I don't remember if that's the As Yet Untitled podcast or where, but he's now Brian from Central PA. He says, of course, Things Are Looking Up is always great. I loved the first episode of Thesis of Fantasy. I was ROTFL in just the first 3 minutes. It took you that long? I mean, it took me that long to get a laugh out of you? Oh, that's terrible. Looking forward to more, parentheses, if there is more, end parentheses. Well, I was struck by his comment, the first episode of Thesis of Fantasy, and I thought, perhaps and episode 2 would be in order. A sequel! But what to do? What to do? Maybe the further adventures of Bane. Yes, Rich Siegfried would love the further adventures of Bane, I'm sure. But I think, Brian, it may end up just being a one-off. And, well, you know, they say, leave them wanting more. So, anyway, I'm working on a secret project right now. It is an audio drama of the purest sense. And when I say the purest sense, I mean, you know, those kinds of audio dramas that were prevalent on the internet starting in 2002. I'm not going to go any further into detail. A lot of you could probably figure out what that is. The script is in the works. It's coming along very nicely, actually. I like where the story is going. I'm sort of writing it as I go along in script format, which is kind of weird. But it's working. So we'll see what happens. Very ambitious project, though. But I think you're going to like the results. I will accept applications for voice talent. But I have my eye on a few that I think I'd like to go with. But, you know, there's always hope for the rest of you, right? Yes, the rest of you. And then on to the next one. This comes from Michael Spence. And Michael Spence follows me on Twitter. Awesome. I like this guy. Michael Spence is pretty cool. He, you know, is pretty cool. And that's pretty much all I know about Michael Spence. But Michael Spence says he found the podcast by looking for Thesis of Fantasy. And he said he intended to pounce on it as soon as the feed address was released. Little did he know, well, it's this feed address. But he probably knows now. And he was interested in what Chris Walker, his feedback, had to say about Christianity and podcasting. There was a big there. And he said it was engaging. But I'm not going to really go further than that. And said that he liked the whole Shepherd Book thing. He liked Chris Walker's take on what Shepherd Book had to say. But anyway, Michael Spence has a blog, and it is entitled Brother Osric, O-S-R-I-C, .marscreativeprojects.com. And he has a really, really interesting article on serenity and the topic of faith, which I think people of all persuasions will find interesting. Because it really... Well, it's interesting. I mean, I can't think up anything to say. It's like, I mean, I know it's only like 9 o'clock at night, and I haven't had anything to drink, more's the pity. And, well, I just can't think of anything else to say, really. Other than I really appreciate Michael Spence listening. And, so anyway, that's it for that. But we're going to come back, and I'll have a special sharing session with you. A little show and tell. Actually, a little hear and tell. Yes, hear and tell. Back in a minute.
Of Scott Sigler.
You've descended into the inner darkness of Phil Rossi.
Now,
journey into the imagination of T. Morris.
This is Moravi Remastered,
the world's first podcast novel reimagined with a new soundtrack, restored scenes,
and the voice talents of Leanne Mabry,
Christiana Ellis, Philippa Ballantyne,
and George Harab.
And the podcast continues in the fall of 2008 with Legacy of Moravi.
And in 2009 with an original podcast anthology, The Dragon Clan of Moravi.
A project so sweeping in scope.
An adventure so epic in scale.
It takes two ballsy voiceover professionals
to cut the promo.
Moravi Remastered.
Pirates. Ninjas.
And one hell of a good time.
Subscribe at www.moravi.net.
And enjoy the ride.
This is the awesome that greets you when you first listen to the new album from Nightwish called Dark Passion Play. It is amazing. I mean, I don't think you understand how amazing this is. Yeah, sure, you've heard chicks singing high-pitched things before, but this isn't Enya. Okay, this isn't Diane Arkenstone, though awesome she is too. And this is so not like Phil Rossi, though Phil Rossi is awesome too. This is Nightwish, and they're from Finland, the land of Finns. Yes, Finns! Behold the awesome of Nightwish. Orchestra to like double bass heavy metal. That's awesome. Sorry, I'm geeking out a little bit over here. Oh Christ, how I hate what I have become. Take me home. Get away, run away, fly away, lead me astray to dreamers. Hide away, I cannot cry, come to shore that cries for. I think the thing that amazes me most of all is how they can afford the orchestra and the choir it takes to do this. And this is phenomenal. This is not something you can do with GarageBand, okay? This is not even something you can do with InSonic. Though InSonic is the awesome, there's no way. It's just phenomenal. And I feel like I want to move to Finland, because maybe then my little rock band could afford an orchestra and a choir. If I even had a rock band. I have to learn to speak Finnish. But anyway, this is beside the point. Nightwish has many flavors to it. Some metal, some... Well, let's check this one out. That song you just heard was The Poet and the Pendulum. It's a 13-minute song from the latest album. But well worth all 13 minutes because it moves like a symphony. It's just amazing. But let's check this one out. This one is called Bye Bye Beautiful. And it's the awesome. Jason Picton II here. I know exactly what you're thinking, because I was thinking the exact same thing, except for you, Dickie, because I know that you're into Nightwish, and have been for some time. For the rest of you who think this is just an Evanescence knockoff, I give you this little number. I know, you're still not convinced, but that's okay, because I can convince you. I can play the awesome and have you become a believer, right? I mean, I did Thesis of Fantasy, yes? Exactly. I know, like, every single one of my listeners listens to Moravi because of my recommendation, right? Yeah, sure. Anyway, later on in the song, can Evanescence do this? I didn't think they could. I mean, where is Evanescence now? Bunch of losers. I mean, the girl goes like, I'm gonna be my own little world here. And Evanescence goes, we're gonna keep being this pseudo-goth alternative band. Look at us, we're amazing. No, you're not. I mean, you got together over meatloaf. And I don't mean the food. Yeah, I once got together with someone over meatloaf. I don't mean romantically, I mean musically. You know where it went? Nowhere. I mean, you know, Meatloaf has got his place in society, but come on. I mean, just because the guy could play Anything for Love on the piano, they start a band. Now look where they are. I mean, come on. It's ridiculous. They're stupid. Oh, we're goth. Look at us. No, you're not. You're a bunch of pretenders. You're a bunch of posers. A bunch of hosers, as Dickie would say. A, yeah, and while I'm at it, so is T. Morris. He's a hoser. Not really. He's my pal. Anyway, that's an aside. Two more bits of awesome. Let's do the old lead singer. Her name was Tarja. I don't know how to pronounce her last name. I don't even remember the last name. The new lead singer is Annette, though she is from Sweden, I believe. I could be wrong about that, yeah. No. I'm stupid. No, Tarja, maybe she was Swedish too, I don't remember. You know what? I'm not going to go out on a limb here. Okay, thank you. She was an operatically trained singer. And this is some of the awesome that they came up with her. This is some of the awesome they came up with her. And then there's one last bit of awesome, also from the album called Once from 2005. And this is widely regarded as one of many people's, most people's, favorite songs of Nightwish. It's, frankly, one of the most beautiful things I've ever heard. And if you don't think so, I don't like you anymore. About you guys, but I would go to nightwish.com and check them out. If any of this has piqued your interest, I guarantee you there is so much more. Their lyrics are full of such poetic imagery and depth that they just put Jim Steinman and Evanescence and whoever else you could think of that they sound like to absolute shame. Absolute shame, in my ever so humble opinion.
Years into the future, mankind has conquered the solar system. Humanity has entered a new era of peace and exploration, but a looming threat could spell the end of everything. The fate of civilization rests in the hands of an unlikely hero.
Excuse me, hero? You know, I've been called a lot of things over the years. Criminal, con artist, traitorous bitch. But hero? Well, yes, but they were being sarcastic. This is the story of how I saved the universe.
Space Casey is an audio drama miniseries from Christiana Ellis. Subscribe now at www.spacecasey.com.
You'll love it. Trust me.
All right, well, let's get to some of your favorite episodes of the various series and kind of tie into what each incarnation of Trek means in the scope of the whole thing.
Okay. Well, this gets harder the more we go at it. Like, original series?
Yeah.
This is my, you know, I got my new five and two, but my two favorites are During the Babel and Doom and Finish.
Yeah.
Since I was a kid, all the way, and, you know, close behind by City and on the Edge and Tribbles and you know Mirror Mirror and Muck Time and and those guys, you know, your major classics. And my favorite period, now this is heresy to a lot of people because they talk about the first season being the season that Gene used mainstream sci-fi writers,
mm-hmm.
and the characters were more grounded and Kirk was much more dramatic and it hadn't started to become, not a parody of itself, but they hadn't started to coast along. But my favorite span of the show, for the most part, is very end of the first season, but the meat of the second season. Mm-hmm. And now I'm old enough to go back and I go, oh, that's when Gene Kuhn was really involved, and Dorothy Fontana had been allowed to write some, and all that. But I mean, I even have an underdog. My top underdog show of the series that gets underappreciated is Friday's Child.
Okay.
Well, there's a yawning.
I don't know episode names.
Huh?
I don't know episode names. I can go that one where Kirk said that one thing that you know.
Yeah. No, Friday's Child. Well, you were with me on Babel and on Doomsday Machine, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Friday's Child is the one with Julie Newmar as the pregnant queen of the planet, where they've come down to negotiate their mining treaty, and they find out there's Klingons that beat them to it, and they're supporting the old guy's rival in a coup.
Yeah.
And they wind up on the wrong side of the little revolution that happens right before their eyes.
Yeah.
And anyway, Julie Newmar, you know, Catwoman, and.
Mm-hmm.
And all is in it, but it's a great character show because everybody is used, and there's some little in jokes, but it's, you know, there's also pieces of day-to-day life that you see. They have a real briefing on a culture before they go down, and McCoy is in the middle of it because there's comic stuff for him. You couldn't tell that McCoy is my favorite character. Okay. I think I mentioned D.
Yeah.
I just think, and there's some great parallel writing. There's one bit where they're under the gun, and inside McCoy's with the pregnant queen and her baby. There's a whole lot of funny stuff about the baby is the child is mine, the child is mine, and
mm-hmm.
him touching her like a doctor, and she slaps him, and he slaps her back. Now you've seen it, right? Am I conjuring this up, or you're thinking about it for the first time?
Flickers.
Okay. Flicker. But there's one great thing where they're in the cave, and McCoy's in the cave with the baby, and Spock is out trying to make bows and arrows in this society that has like throwing stars.
Yeah.
What do you got? And he's, the introduction of a bow and arrow will be as shocking to them as you know, gunpowder was on Earth by the Chinese. But they're both under the gun, they're both a little down, and he's inside, and McCoy's down, and he says, I don't know, Jim, I can't do blah, blah, blah. And he says, that's all right, Doctor, I guess I expect too much out of you. And McCoy immediately goes, I didn't say I couldn't do it, kind of a thing. He goes outside, and Spock's like, I don't know what in the world we're going to do with these bows and arrows, blah, 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 and Kirk says, I know, Mr. Spock, sometimes I guess I just expect too much out of you. And he's like, well, I didn't say we were going to fail. I mean, but it was, and I don't know how old I was. I was in my, I was past 30, and I went, oh, that's great writing. They just did a little parallel bit there, and, if you stop and think about it. So anyway, that's my underappreciated. Mm-hmm. I remember Mark Altman and Robert Burnett, and the year I did a TS9 package for Mark's old Sci-Fi Universe magazine, and they did a promo thing at the Grand Slam in Pasadena, and we were talking about our favorite shows, and I said that is my like dark horse number five or something, and everybody was poo-pooing me, and I got up and I said ding ding, I went down the list, this, and everybody's like, okay,
my favorite
original series, the 80 shows that we all watched for 20 or 30 years over and over again and memorized. And then from there on in, it gets tougher because everything else was, there's so much of it, and they cranked it out. And, people love that. Be careful what you wish for. You may get it.
Right.
So, I'm sorry, I cut you off.
My favorites in the original series, I guess, were always the Harry Mudd, because I always appreciated the comedy,
Yeah, especially the second one, And see, I Mudd is from that second season span when they were really, mm-hmm. I think, the maturity of the series format.
Yeah.
Before the dreaded third season. Which is funny, because so many people now don't get, there was a time when, when that was all we had, and there was this whole nose in the air section of fandom that would say, I don't accept the third season. I just ignore the third season. The way a lot of people want to say, I ignore Enterprise. I just don't think it happened.
The prequels didn't happen.
Yeah. I just ignore it. Well, people used to do that about the third season, and it's funny now because I remember writing about that, and people looked at me like I was crazy. Like, what?
Yeah.
I was like, no. And it wasn't necessarily mine. I know there's some real stinkers too, but Spock's character was so totally manipulated and abused in the third season that he would never do those things. Gene was not running the show, and it was just not on,
Are you channeling the comic book guy from The Simpsons?
I don't know. I always watch The Simpsons, but I haven't watched every single hour, so maybe I am. Maybe the Simpsons comic book guy was channeled from me.
Oh.
And I'm too late to stake my claim, and I probably missed it by 7 years.
But that is totally something he would say. I just completely ignore the third season. It didn't happen.
That shows what an iconic character the comic book guy is.
Yeah.
That goes back to your 70s fandom there, but I, you know, which I heard through my mother's womb. So there we go.
Yes. Same here. What about Next Gen?
Well, Next Gen was the one I remember writing about because I did the companion for Next Generation.
Right.
And waded through them all, and it started off as a fan endeavor and wound up being under the gun for, you know, to get on pocketbook deadlines, kind of impossible things. But to start off watching the pilot at a little viewing party and knowing nothing about it aside what we got from Starlog and from Interstat and the little crumbs we could get versus the finale where I was out while they were filming it and madly working on the book and everything and interviewing everybody. It was kind of an odd turnaround for me. But some of them stand out, like Yesterday's Enterprise, aside from the story being by one of my good friends, Eric Stilwell, that used to work here in the franchise and is now up at the University of Oregon back in his home environment and very happy. But, all you know, and you know, his boss, Michael Piller, passed way too soon. But at the time, when he was script coordinator, and that aired, and I wasn't really jumping the gun with anything other than little promo things they would send out. And I remember watching that, and when it ended, and Picard says, "Let's make sure history never forgets the name, Enterprise," you know, and the flames are licking everybody, and they're all dying and falling down. And I just remember thinking, wow, they have finally, because those first 2 years, the fans were whole, you know, the first year was rocky, the second year you could see some progress, the third was kind of, I mean, at the time, just experiencing as a fan, not sitting here going, oh, well, they're having a horrible revolving door of writers, and now Michael Piller has stepped in, and it's crazy, but he's gradually getting wrestling control of the writing, you know, staff, and the quality's good. Now I can sit back and analyze that, but at the time, like the little girl at the Shakespeare play, you know, sitting through it, going, oh, I can tell this, and oh, it's a hopeful sign, and oh, that was, you know, that was a great show, and oh, the next couple stunk, or they weren't up to what they could have been, and they're pretty thin. But watching Yesterday's Enterprise, it flashed to me, it's like, they have finally, the show is going to make it, they're going to surpass just being a TV show, echo clone of the original. That was as exciting and dramatic as any of the movies have ever been.
Yeah.
And this was a half, and then the season ended with, I mean, we still had to go through, you know, The Offspring and Sins of the Fathers and start the Klingon Saga and, you know, the first Barclay show and some of the other character building shows. They had a rough first half of the season, and then they really started cranking them out. And then he ended up with Best of Both Worlds, and then that's when they set the world on fire. And Star Trek and Next Gen was the coolest, zingiest, geekiest. You know, if we had the internet then. It was very infant, but if we'd had, you know, the web then and all, that would have been the thing that lit everybody up, just like some of these events do. But that was the original mega event. The whole world was watching that come back, you know, the season opener the next year after the, you know, when Picard shows his little, comes out his little cutest of Borg and the little red laser is shining and and people, all, and it flashes up to be continued, and it was their first cliffhanger. Two-parter, you know, and people all over the world were screaming at their TVs. And that's when TNG hit the, you know, that's when they were on the map and they could almost do no wrong after that. So that's my, you know, those two are favorites, but I know The Inner Light's a real soft one.
I love The Inner Light.
You know, one of Hugo. I mean, I really loved it. My basic thing is, from then on, I lived them, I saw them firsthand, and nothing will ever be the original series because you had 80 shows to watch over and over again for 20 years, no competition, and we all knew them by heart, and you all knew what your favorites were.
Right.
And since then, nobody's had the. We're only now getting reflection time for Next Gen, much less all the rest of them. So it gets harder, but I mean, there's the ones, the funny ones. You know, my God, give me some comedy. You know, the Q shows are good, and like I said, those were. I just remember Yesterday's Enterprise being a real landmark to me, watching it going, oh.
Right.
And, you know, some of the shows like Data's Day, that's kind you know, a good day in the life. And I remember watching The Wounded and saying, oh, Colin Meaney, they finally gave him a decent part there as O'Brien. And and the scene where the captain and his old captain, who's kind of like gone off the deep end, kind of pulled a Captain Queeg kind of a thing, and he knows, he's quit running, and he knows the jig is up, and the camera, they sing this old Irish, the minstrel boy,
right.
And the camera does a, I forget who the director is, they do a, it, but it, the great camera just circles them as they do this, and at the end of it, he says, I'm not going to get out of this, am I, Chief? And he says, no, sir, you're not. It was just like, ooh, you know, so anyway.
I was
about that all night, but.
The ones, I guess, that stand out to me, and you may have already named the episodes, are the ones where they kind of step out of the of their world, in particular the Sherlock Holmes stuff, and the one with Mark Twain, whatever that one was.
Yeah, and Jerry Harden decides he's going to go off and do Mark Twain one-man shows, like Hal Holbrook used to do after
right.
that. It made such an impact on him. Yeah, and it's funny because, you know, and David Gerald wrote his critiques in some of his books, his World of Star Trek book, and I went back to those and pointed them out about what was wrong with the original series and when they did Next Gen. Here's what we're going to fix. We're not going to make the same mistakes again. You know, we can't have the transporter breaking down every, you know, we can't have it breaking down and that's it. Who would use this technology if it was that cranky, you know?
Yeah.
And then, lo and behold, they create the holodeck and, you know, and now it's the holodeck that breaks down for some reason or whatever, you know?
And locks people.
Sure, huh?
Locks people inside strange worlds that they can't get out of.
Yeah. They're under threat. And then, so then it became not just that to have a holodeck show, but to have the holodeck show without the horrible gimmick of, you know, death and threatening. So and then it became like on DS9 and a little bit on Voyager, but then it was like the, okay. And I remember when DS9 did Our Man Bashir, they were so, Bob Gillen, who was my wife's colleague on DS9 as the assistant script coordinator, he was so thrilled with the story that they came up with because it wasn't the holodeck that broke down, it was the holodeck saved people. But in saving them, you know, they were on a runabout, they beamed them in, but they had all this raw pattern storage, and the only thing that had big enough storage were the holosuites at Quark, so they had to dump everybody into that. Well, the program that was running was his secret agent program, so it dumped them into those patterns, and it was pretty believable. You know, it wasn't just the old holodeck broke down again.
Yeah.
Why do we even risk our lives going to
right.
something that's supposed to be recreation? I could kill myself on greasy squares, you know, much less do this. And they were like, how can we do this and have it be, have the jeopardy and the threat, but not have it be the poor technology's fault. So.
Mm-hmm. The thing...
Yeah, but everybody loves the show, and of course they love doing them. They love doing the, you know, Sherlock Holmes and the Dixon Hill, you know, film noir stuff, and anytime they got to do. And, you know, that was the other thing. Instead of going back in time, what do you mean a Roman planet? What do you mean a Nazi planet, like on the original series? Like, no, we can do that. We can have the costume shows. We just do it in holodeck, and it's all okay.
Yeah, it all fits. The thing that struck me about Deep Space Nine as I move forward, Next Gen always, you had the characters, you kind of knew who they were, and they had their personalities, but it was kind of, there were kind of major points being made in every episode. It was kind of like the end of G.I. Joe, where there was always a moral to the story or something. But
well, hopefully not as bad as... Yeah.
No, not quite as cheeky, but...
And what did we learn today, kid?
Yeah. Don't cross the railroad tracks without looking, Flint. That's right, kids.
And if you insist on doing it, try to have a prepaid funeral plan before you go.
But Deep Space Nine always struck me as being far more deep as far as the relationships where the characters were concerned. And I always felt like it was far more intent on showing that personal interaction rather than the overarching sort of thing.
Yeah, well, that was, you know, they started it, and Michael Piller left to go off and do some things, and Ira Bear came in, and his whole thing was, you know, we're not going to have Technobabble Jr.
Yeah.
And we want the characters. The crazy thing about DS9, you know, the knock on it was, well, it doesn't move. So it's boring. And we have these little dinky runabouts. And how could you have big space battles and dinky runabouts? Well, they wound up having some pretty kick-ass space battles by the time the show was over. But
yeah,
it had that, you know, I didn't think about it that way. I don't know if, because of the first couple of years we were watching at home before coming out here and getting onto the, you know, the inside, the money track side of things and earning a living here and being that involved in it. But I remember watching those you know, the early shows are really intriguing. And their pilot just blew me out of the water when you were like, whoa, you know, the whole thing of everything from the battle at the first to the whole thing with the prophets and the the white, you know, the everybody assuming another character and being in that white void, you know, having the two arc story going on at the same time. And then they had to pull back and have some really low, but not low budget, but have some real insular shows. But the whole thing of having the own environment and having the humans, you know, the thing that kills me and why I'm mad that I didn't, you know, write this down and put it in a time capsule. When I was working on my book, and again, I didn't get to get out of here till the fifth season, the sixth season, Next Gen. I was working on The Companion, and you started. I started talking to Michael and Ron Moore and Renee Echevarria and Narain and Jerry Taylor, and all of them would say, and they would talk about the writers that would come on, and some writers could click, and some just didn't work in Star Trek, even though they were great writers, they'd won awards and all. And talking about, it's hard to write in the TNG world that Gene set up, where the humans are basically so elevated that they're all pretty much perfect, get along, and you've got to have your threats come, you know, dramatically. Every drama story, any you know, story has to be about some conflict somewhere. And it can't all be man versus nature. Most of the time it's man versus man. So, you know, how to do that, how to have it always come from without and be interesting and still have the, everybody not be just big piles of vanilla, you know.
Yeah.
And to have the technology and the history and the sophistication and the, oh, we've just learned so much because we're so enlightened, you know, humans in Federation. You know, God, can't they just screw up once in a while? And some of the writers would come in and want to do things. No, we did that in the second season, or they're way beyond that. And I remember thinking how great it would be to do a series set before the Federation where you showed everybody learning their mistakes, and they didn't have technology to save their ass every week, and you still had people making mistakes, and they could still go off half-cocked or whatever, but they were noble and, you know, and they were learning, and you, and then you laid down the touchstones, and you could even have fun with it of going forward.
Yeah.
And I wish I had written that down, and, you know, then I could have showed up and demanded a piece of Enterprise. Because that's exactly what they, well, that was the idea. And then now, whether the, you know, the execution was all over the map. That was the idea. And so, yeah, so DS9 was about, you know, well, let's, that was one way of getting at that. Let's take our perfect humans and stick them here at this crossroads with greedy Ferengi and glowering Klingons and sneaky Romulans and Nazi Cardassians, and, you know, and my God, we'll even have money again, because not everybody is cashless like the Federation, even though they've all got replicators, so what's, anyway, we won't go there. But, yeah, so I thought it was great. Like I said, the only thing I hate is now to go back and do stills and everybody walks around in shadows and they're not even Klingons on smoky Klingon ships. You're trying to find a clean look at something and all, but, yeah, the thing about DS9 also was they had 40,628 sub-characters.
Oh, my gosh.
No, but if you think about the depth of the well of how many running characters they had beyond the... To the point where it got to the last couple of years where I know the regular cast was a little upset at times because you'd have shows that were all... Like, the title's escaping me. But it's the follow-up to the Siege of AR-558, where it's just Vic Fontaine and Nog, who are like running recurring characters.
Yeah.
And 80% of the show is not the regulars, you know.
Right.
And you get into that part, and but that's also the beauty of the show. I mean, just as a fan and as a watcher and an enjoyer of it, they had so many characters. There were so many and so many great actors who were in those. You know, Louise Fletcher and Andy Robinson, and getting Jimmy Darren out of retirement to play Vic, and not just be a singer, but to do, you know. So, yeah. And then DS9, you're talking about episodes, you didn't mention any. We didn't mention any.
No, because I couldn't remember any particular, because I kind of sort of fell out of regular Star Trek watching at that point. But.
Yeah. Was it just other things got you, or here, look, I've lapsed into my own interviewer mode here.
Well,
or was it that it really demanded you keep, it was the serial way the shows, by the time they got into the Dominion War and you had to keep up with the plots and you had to watch every week and they weren't standalone, did that?
Uh, probably. I think that may be it. Not being able to follow. It's kind of like a person who comes into 24 in the fifth episode. But yeah, I guess it just felt like it wasn't what I was used to, and I guess I sort of it was on at the wrong time, or
yeah,
you know, I was in college.
Did you go back and watch Voyager then? You're talking about what you're used to being like a standalone show, like the original Next Gen had mostly been,
right?
They wrapped up every week, and they didn't. There were broad things they would keep running, like Worf's saga.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's in and out of Klingon favor. Or, okay, are Riker and Troy being cutesy this season, or are they not? Or, you know.
Yeah, I think just during its initial run, I just, you know, I guess I was just doing other things, and you know, wasn't as into it. And I've never been as into it as a lot of people, but I've always enjoyed it when I've seen it.
The thing
about Voyager that I couldn't get into it was just it seemed like just another rehash to me, I guess. It just the only thing different was we got a female captain and a Cherokee Indian for first officer.
Yeah, because he wasn't Cherokee. That was part of the thing, was they couldn't figure out what he was. I can say this now. The Indian advisors, they wanted to have this great idea, and then they didn't want to do anything because they didn't want to offend any of the different tribes.
Yeah.
I have the utmost respect for Native, you know, American peoples as I do anybody's ethnic heritage, but
right.
I thought it was odd. It's like, well, it's in the future, and we take, everybody's in the future. They don't, you know, the French and the Irish stuff and, you know, Sid was, you know, Mideastern, and the idea of, we're going to honor them, but you can't say anything because it would be too realistic. Well, everybody's updated to 400 years into the future, and so they, you know, Chakotay got watered down. He didn't have a background to lean on, or it had to be invented. And
mm-hmm.
It got watered down real fast.
Well, and I think finally,
and plus the casting. I mean,
yeah.
he's good at that, but they were looking for, when they did the Journey's End episode of Next Gen, and they had all the Native Americans, and you knew they were North American, you know, Native Americans, and that's what they were, that was actually supposed to be the setup for that, but they had to cast so differently that they wound up kind of watering down that whole thing that they had tried to set up for that.
So, yeah. And I kind of,
if you look at the extras, this is funny. If you go back and look at them, because they had those Maquis shows, right?
Mm-hmm.
The launch, Voyager's background of Maquis. TNG had the two, had Journey's End and had Preemptive Strike. And then DS9 had the Maquis, two-parter. And in the Maquis on DS9, when they go to that council house, and those extras, who are Maquis people, all come running in from to surround them from the little side secret doors.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, oh, look, there's a black Vulcan, and there's a Native American guy, and there's a kind of lightly featured Klingon woman. It was like, they had all these people that were kind of like, almost like they were subliminally getting you ready for the
yeah.
for the Maquis on Voyager by introducing all these, like, possible types. It was just kind of a little subtle thing. I'll challenge anybody with the DVDs to go back and watch that on the DS9 DVD of the Maquis for that. Because it hit me, it was like, cause a year later, it was like, wait a minute, it's not the real actors weren't in there. They were just sending in those character types to get you conditioned for Voyager. But anyway.
Well, and I was going to say, I felt like the Black Vulcan was just an experiment. You know, they didn't really seem to do anything with him.
Yeah, except that, remember on Next Gen, there was the Black Romulan?
I don't recall.
okay. What are you doing? In the Pegasus, in the last season, they came up with this whole scandal, secret hero covert thing for Riker and Admiral Pressman, who now is, what's his name, John Locke on Lost.
Mm-hmm.
He'll always be Admiral Pressman to me, I'm sorry. this whole thing of a covert thing, but they had a secret, like, renegade Starfleet group doing a cloaking device, and it was on the ship that little Ensign Riker, little wide-eyed guy out of the Academy, was on.
Yeah.
And he made the choice to go down with the mutineers who opposed once they found out about it. But anyway, the whole show is they go and they're looking for this ship that phased inside an asteroid because the test failed and a lot of people were killed and trapped there, and they're trying to get it out, but they're still having to be sneaky. And the Romulans are sneaking around attacking it, but the Romulan commander in that episode is a black actor.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's kind of like, oh, it's setting up the whole thing of there's different races in the Vulcanoid species as well as, you know, humans. So.
Right. Okay. Wow.
A little esoteric there, are we, or what?
Almost covered the whole TV spectrum there.
Yeah. Well, we didn't talk much about Voyager, but...
Well, did you... Did you think it was a rehash, or what did they do differently that the other shows didn't?
Well, I think Voyager was sad because we watched the, and my wife worked on Voyager.
Right.
So we saw the crew screening of the pilot, and it was so, I thought every pilot got better. DS9's pilot blew me away when I watched it. Mm-hmm. This one, and maybe I was part of the thing of being here and being involved, but it blew me away too. The sad thing about Voyager was, like, three-fourths of what the show set up in the pilot, they immediately backed away from.
Yeah.
Went vanilla on.
Huh.
My Janet, my wife, will tell convention groups, and she said for years she wanted the first year or two of the show. She says I wanted to sit down and watch the show and not know who was sitting in the captain's chair. Was it going to be Janeway or B'Elanna or Janeway or Chakotay? Not that they were an armed camp, but that there would be really a tense situation going.
Mm-hmm.
And that really wasn't the. They'd set up all this, and the Chakotay-Paris conflict went out the window, and the fact that Neelix and Kes were supposed to be alien lovers went out the window, and all kinds of things got just thrown out immediately.
Hmm.
And a lot of that came from, I hate to say, the network at the time, UPN, sitting on them to do a lot of that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Oh, it's Star Trek. We can't be too edgy. That's what you want.
That's the thing that got me, was Gene was so on the forefront of these things. He was so edgy in his own writing and his own plots. They confronted everything head on.
Yeah.
I mean, back in the 60s, they're confronting racism in the 60s and with the two guys that had black and white on either side.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
And it was just, that's another thing that got me, was it didn't...
But no, the Riddler would be an alien the racist. Frank Gorsham, yep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it just struck me as I guess being kind of watered down, and maybe that's why I lost interest.
Yeah, and that's basically what they set up, this great pilot, and I'll say no fault of the staff there. They kind of were responding to some pressure to that. Then it was like, oh, well, all the stuff. So now they're stuck because they already had set the challenge up. It was very daring to go, we're going to cut loose from all the known everything.
Mm-hmm.
The known alpha, beta, quadrant stuff, and go over here where we can't rely on family. The old TV tricks are, my uncle, my dad, my mom, my lost sister, brother, evil twin showed up.
Yeah.
None of that, And we don't have Romulans, Klingons, and Borg. The Borg eventually. I'm being facetious, but mm-hmm. All the known races, and that became tough on the writers, and then all the designers had to come up with things that made sense. Time after time after time. And then if you had a running quote-unquote villain like the Kazon, who were probably the worst ever, it's like that old phrase, nobody sets out to make a bad movie,
mm-hmm.
They don't do it on purpose. They didn't set out to make the Kazon be just doofuses. But the junkyard dog aliens of Trek was what they were supposed to be, but it just looked like watered down Klingons with sponge hair. But aside from how well they played, the longer they dealt with them, the more it looked like Voyager was standing still. And after 2 years of that, they said, well, this is silly. We're not going anywhere.
Yeah.
So that's the reason they left them behind. And then the great thing about the Borg was, and everybody was saying, the Borg are in the Delta Quadrant. When are you going to get to them? Don't rush that. And then they do that one little show, and First Contact comes out, and then they go, it's the Borg.
Yeah.
But at least they could be, they had their transwarp conduits and can pop in and out. You didn't get that feeling.
Yeah.
So some of the races, like the Herosians, would come along. You could dabble with them for a while, and the 8472s,
So
they kind of screwed that up where they're from another realm, fluidic space. And then, like, a couple of years later, they said, that's a planet over near the fluidic space. It's like, no, it's not a concrete position. It's a, it's a transdimensional layer or whatever.
Yeah.
But anyway.
How did Voyager last for 7 seasons then?
Because the bean counters, it wasn't that horrible, and it was the best thing on UPN most of the time, because UPN stayed... Voyager was not that bad, because UPN was such a crippled little network. If they had at least had 100% penetration of the country like the Big Four do, instead of maybe
60
or 75% of the country, and not had crappy little stations where half the time it was... I always had people saying, it's on a station where they have to show hockey. During the winter or something, and it would be bumped off. The numbers would have been, at least 5 to 10% better, just that they'd had a full national grid
uh-huh.
on and not have to put up with crap like that. But even then, bean counter, sit down and go, okay, we're going to spend this much per episode for this long. You know, unless it's just horrible, then they stick with that.
Yeah.
And, you know, and having, and then rejiggering the format in the middle of the run and having Seven come in, you know, and having Jerry Ryan, who was not something great to look at and splash over every magazine cover in America with that cat suit, but she actually was a great actress, and the character had a great concept to it. So it was kind of like Data Inside Out kind of thing.
You just made a lot of fanboys angry saying she wasn't anything to look at.
No, I said she was something to look at.
Oh, okay.
She wasn't only something to look at.
I got
she
you.
Wasn't just eye candy.
I got you.
Eye candy with a brain.
Yeah. Okay.
No. Oh, I would never make... I would never talk down.
Wow, Larry Nemechek blast 7 of 9.
And she likes it. No.
Oh.
Okay.
Hey.
And Jerry was so funny when she was first there. She was like on a... She came over and did the chats at StarTrek.com, and she still had the record. She would come over, like they usually would do, 30 minutes to an hour, and then the actors would want to, you know, and it was there on the lot at the time. She stayed 2 to 3 hours, not just once, but again the next year. They couldn't get, the second time they were having to, like, push her out the door. She was having so much fun, and it was kind of funny, compared to the later years when the stalker guy had them all freaked, and she wouldn't do conventions, you know, or they had to have an honor guard of 19 off-duty deputies.
Right.
You know, I mean, I understand what was going on there, but yeah, no, it's you know, and Voyager had some great shows that kind of rose above. I still think Distant Origin is a great show. It's a great Star Trek show, no matter what series it's on. Where they it was kind of a whole take on evolution versus not evolution versus creationism, but about science versus dogma.
Yeah.
And when you've got the facts staring you in the face. And you're sticking to it because you just can't unhinge your whole thought process comes up, your whole self-image comes apart.
Mm-hmm.
And they had these, you're not familiar with, there's a dinosaur race they stumble into, and then they find out that there's actually a little controversy among them, and this radical scientist figures out by looking at some human bones that they had a connection, and they have a whole history built up of they arose on their planet, you know, as intelligent Saurians, and they're going, no, your DNA markers go back with us. And they're like, we did not run away from a planet as ignorant, you know, semi-ignorant reptilians and have any shared DNA with you primates. And then it's about the government clamping down on this guy. It's kind of like Copernicus again, clamping down on this guy, even though the facts are there, and Chakotay's trying to help him out.
Yeah.
Anyway, it was a really well done show, and, there's a few more Voyagers like that, but I think everybody was universally disappointed in the finale. It kind of just like rushed them home, and then bang, there was nothing to savor at the end. They didn't get to do anything at the end.
But, yeah. Now,
yeah, the Doctor and Seven were kind of breakouts. I think there were a lot of characters that never got to really be developed until like they tried to crank stuff at the end.
Right. Yeah, I did think there were some creative things that they did with the characters especially, and so, you know, there are definitely a lot of episodes that I enjoyed, you know, and it was rare that I guess that I didn't really enjoy it, but just kind of as a whole, I guess I didn't embrace it. Now, as far as Enterprise is concerned, I think I watched maybe 10 minutes of Enterprise during its whole run.
You couldn't make it out of the pilot, is that what you're saying?
I couldn't even catch the pilot, I guess. It was just maybe on at the wrong time for me, but I just never could really just get into it, I guess. It just seemed almost more the same. It was like maybe it was Quantum Leap in pajamas. I don't know.
Well, that was very interesting because, like I said, if I'd, you know, written it down and dated it and filed it with the WGA, maybe I could have yelled later on, but no, I'm kidding. But I was excited. The sad thing was, and not to, you know, stir up old stuff, but as the show split, one of the mistakes, I think, everybody got so caught up in Star Trek fever was having a second show.
Mm-hmm.
Because what they didn't realize happened, not so much at the time, but then when Next Gen ended and Voyager and Deep Space were running, it really kind of started dividing and diluting the audience right when the very success of Next Generation as a genre, as visual effects, as all kinds of, as syndication pioneering into the cable network, you started having all, you know, Xena and Hercules and
Jeans.
And but you had all kinds of genre shows coming out, and the you know, Sci-Fi Channel was coming along and doing things, and the audience started to loop down a little bit from where TNG had it all to itself.
Yeah.
In the beginning. And then there's not one but two Star Treks on after TNG's over, and it's even, I mean, to this day there are people who are, they're more fans of DS9 than they are of any other Star Trek.
Hmm.
I mean, Michael used to call them the Niners. Talk about how, and somewhere between being the middle child, stepchild syndrome, and just that darker, rich tapestry of all those characters, and it wasn't squeaky clean Starfleet running around bopping from planet to planet kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But then there are people that's what they like, and they like the standalone, you know, adventure. So there was this split going on, and a lot of that, between that and the competition, with, now I sound like Rick Berman, but the competition from old Star Trek reruns and next-gen reruns even, you know, it was, and just everything exploding, the internet coming along and all the cable channels exploding, and there was just a lot more things you could get into.
Yeah.
The old-time Star Trek audience, typical audience person could do that. And so Enterprise, I love the idea. Like I said, I've been saying for years they could do that. I wanted to see the time frame explored, and if you went back further in time, you could do those things and have them be heroic and have fun with it. Well, when DS9 ended and then Voyager ended, when Next Generation ended, the writers all split up. And Jerry and Michael went to Voyager and helped co-create that. And Renee and Ron went to, Renee Escher and Ron Moore went over to DS9, and Michael talked Ira back into Trek and got him onto DS9. And so the staff kind of, you know, split up and went different ways. And then when DS9 went down, all of the writers went off to do other things, except Ron, who was going to come over to Voyager, and he thought run the last, you know, like work on the last couple of years, but also help develop the new show.
Mm-hmm.
And the sad thing, and this was the beginning of the sixth season on Voyager, and he did the story for Barge of the Dead, which is a big Klingon show, and then he wrote the Borg show, I think Survival Instinct. But within that month was a very now controversial month where he got the idea from his old, you know, writing partner and his boss that he was not going to be involved in the new show. So, and the gentleman that he is, he, just after about a month of that and dealing with that, because that had been his only, you know, he was a fan and then got in and wrote and had a claim and did the two movies and the finale of Next Gen and wrote great DS9 shows. So he walked away, and now he's got his own resume. You know, he went from Roswell to Carnival and now Galactica. And I remember thinking at the time that they were going to do this prequel show that Ron, you know, to put it nicely, Rick and Brandon's background was not the original series. I was worried. But then knowing Ron was involved, my expectations went way up.
Yeah.
That lasted a whole 30 days. And then when Ron was out of it, I was like back to worrying about it. So when the pilot of Enterprise came out, I remember thinking, well, this isn't as bad as I thought it was going to be. It's not that bad. There were a couple of clunkers about them getting to, you know, Kronos in 4 days. Those were techie, geeky things.
Yeah.
And I was like, okay. And people were upset about the ship shape and all that. And that was an internal, you know, one of the hard things was how all the hands-on people get yelled at for their decisions, but people don't realize that it's the producers that make the decisions. So you couldn't have more fanboys than, like, the art department over the years.
Right.
You know, and even visual effects and, excuse me, all those guys. And some of the, you know, you got to put the responsibility for things at the feet of the guys in charge.
Yeah.
And I remember thinking that was going to be a problem because that's not where they came from, whereas almost all the other writers on the rest of the shows had been old original series fans, but were still professionals in their own right.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And they weren't slaves. They couldn't stop reinventing the original series. Well, let's see. Instead of having a Nazi planet, let's have a communist planet. Okay. I mean, you know. And they all fall into that trap sometimes.
Right. Well, I didn't know Ron Moore cut his teeth on Star Trek.
Oh, yeah. He had a spec script for the... He had just come here. You can get in and research that. But he had just come to L.A. He was from up north, a little town between along with 99 and the 5, where it's wide open farm country. And was down here working odd jobs and, I want to say waiting or maybe even veterinary, but he had some spec scripts, and he wrote the bonding because he was an original series fan and was watching Next Gen and got the bonding before Michael Piller started his open door policy. Got it in, and they were like, oh my God, this is the best spec script we've seen from anybody, much less, you know, an amateur. The pro writers that come in, established writers come in. This is great. This is, and so the bonding was done almost untouched in third season, and then after he got the chance to work on, I forget what the other show was, they brought him on staff.
Wow.
And yeah, so.
He wasn't from Lodi, was he?
No, he was not from Lodi. He's not stuck in Lodi again, yeah.
Because I was born actually in Auburn, so I kind of
a little familiar with
the Central Valley, but I had one more.
I think it was Chowchilla, I think, is where he was from.
Wow. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Even I don't know where that is.
No.
All right, I have one more question for you if you have time.
Okay, yeah.
We have something in common, and that is Sci-Fi Studios.
Oh, yes.
And you've been there since the inception, and I'm a newbie kind of with the magazine. Tell me about what Sci-Fi Studios...
Oh, great. After we got off the ground and I helped them launch, I kind of took on the role of, like, the journalism sponsor at a high school paper or college paper. It's
kind
of like, you know, they're doing the work, and I come in and kind of advise and keep on track, and I'm always there if they need me and jump in sometimes,
like
you were saying.
What was Sci-Fi Studios intended to become... and how do you think things are progressing with that?
Well, they've kind of slacked up. The first idea was a great idea. It was kind of, you know, one of these bold moves because they wanted to take the fans that sit at home and say, my God, I could have done better than this, or why didn't they do that? Fans of the genre of, you know, fantasy and sci-fi and horror, and link them up to, it was trying to be a bridge between producers and actors and writers and all the guilds and crafts that do that kind of thing and get them direct fan feedback. Now, the selling point of the whole thing was, you know, it was kind of like a PBS station where the more your membership fee went up, the more you could do and have input on.
Yeah.
And it was hardly a sham. They were lining up some real talent, because it's a risky thing both ways. I mean, fans think, or members think they're putting in some money for this. But also, it's a risky thing for somebody like, you know, in the film world, entertainment in Hollywood, right? To link up with something like that, you're going to hold yourself open to this. And you know, they were always very careful to say, no, you're not buying a piece of a movie. You're not going to have rights or whatever. But they also saw it as a good way for people, like maybe like Ron Moore, a farm way to break through that. You know, you can't be in a union unless you work, and you can't work unless you're in the union.
Yeah.
I mean, on the writer's side of that, it's hard to get in and get your stuff in and read and make that breakthrough. And offer, and not just for writers, but for directors and designers and up and down visual effects people. And that was a thing. And, you know, and hopefully it was going to hit a critical mass where you had tons of people involved. And you had a lot of people involved, and you started, you know, out of all those people in, that you actually had some people kind of rise to the top and get involved. At the same time, they were giving feedback to writers and actors and directors, you know, novelists, comic book writers, screenplay writers who were looking for feedback on their work.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the big, noble, original plan for the whole thing. And at the same time, if you were just a fan, you didn't care about becoming a professional, but you wanted to enjoy your fandom and you liked to write and you wanted to exercise that, you could do it in kind of a version of a MySpace, Facebook kind of area where you could go in and post your own stuff and other fans could critique you and you could critique or artwork, you know, whatever.
Right.
And then there would be things set up like the magazine that would kind of tie it all in together and springboard from that. So it was all about, you know, getting grassroots involvement in and having contact and actually helping out some of the professionals who got it and saw that kind of concept happen. And it's just very hard to sustain that. I don't talk for Tim or John or anybody involved, but it's really hard to do that while you're waiting for that critical mass to heat up. So they're in the middle of looking. I mean, and that's not to say that there's people still around Hollywood who are interested in that concept. So they're looking at how to turn the corner and get back to that, but also how to have other things happening at the same time with the site. So the next few months may bring some news about that and some more tie-ins to things happening in L.A.
Okay.
That's on the way. I know, and as far as the magazine goes, that's been kind of the same way. If you're, you know, a journalist, writer, or an entertainment writer and wanted to get in, it was going to be a good way to do that, and there's no money happening right now.
Right.
But that was down the road, and in the meantime, it is a great way. I mean, part of the, you know, the deal was I would, you know, at least I would be looking at people's, I say manuscripts, do we even think about a manuscript anymore? Their, you know, their work, and having feedback, and having critique, and having professionals that could, you know, give you feedback on that. If you could bust out of your fan mode and be able to take that and probably do better.
Right.
You know, there was an avenue there for entertainment. Another avenue for people, aspiring people, entertainment journalists and photographers and creative people that way.
Right. Okay, well, I'm going to do the...
Did we beat that to death, or what were you...
that was fine.
What were you after? Yeah, I mean, I didn't know... Yeah, I forgot if you had an actual question in there, but that's the,
I think
that's
it was, how are things progressing, but I think you touched on that.
Yeah, I mean, it got off to a huge start, and then we kind of hit a plateau. It's like, well, you have to have the next, you know, oof up. But it was such an experimental deal, and such kind of a new concept, everybody could see the appeal and where it could go. Sometimes you have to make some tweaks, and, you know, even Next Generation had the first season, so.
Yeah. Well, I really appreciate you doing this, Larry. Honestly, seriously, this has been one of the more interesting discussions I've had, and I really like, you know, talking about our favorite episodes and stuff, and really kind of getting the history of this whole thing, so I really appreciate that.
Wow, if we crammed the whole history of the Star Trek franchise phenomenon...
Perhaps
whatever it's been.
Perhaps I misspoke.
No, I didn't mean that. I mean, wow, pinch me here. We're genius suddenly or something. But no, you know, it's been a great time, and this is what I like about the conventions. Even though sometimes there's a lot of pressure to entertain, and I have, you know, informative talks, but just being able to share, you know, to have been privileged to work with a lot of people I have, and to see some things, and because I know, you know, I would have loved to have had that opportunity with you. Original series way back, but even to catch up on things, much less see it firsthand, and it comes at a price though, because all these years, you know, I've had my brain taken up with Star Trek, where I could have been watching some of the other, you know, good entertainments going by, but I wouldn't trade it for the world, my gosh, let's see what's around the corner.
Yeah,
you know?
Very cool. Well, thanks again, and best of luck on your future endeavors.
Oh, thanks a lot. Things with the tour and the fan club communicators on hiatus. Something may come of that in the next year or so in a new mode. So if you're in Japan, you can keep reading my backfile DVD commentaries. But I don't know if we'll get that far. So anyway, it's been real and it's exciting, and it's been an interesting transition time for everybody. So we'll see what happens.
Get when you put you two, Dog the Bounty Hunter, and two pregnant ladies together. It's either the only news story that keeps Paris Hilton off TV for 5 minutes, or it's three episodes from the Roni's Own Radio Show. Roni's Own Radio. It's views, interviews, and you. Hey, if I can join the show, so can you. Roni's Own Radio at rzrtalk.jrdonline.com.
All right, so maybe that's one of the longer website addresses that you would have to remember. But speaking of Roni's Own Radio, Jeff Roni is the host of that. He was the host of Tatooine TV, which was a long-running comedy Star Wars sketch thing, which you can find at StarWarsFanWorks.com. And I have some lines to record for Jeff Roni for his audio drama production, called New World Army, which is beginning to take shape. It looks like it's really going to be a cool concept. I've heard one of the first rough cut from this thing, and it sounds great. It really does sound great. I will keep you clued in as to when these appearances shall happen. I also have appeared in a couple Star Wars audio dramas recently that are ongoing and running. I've been appearing in Murder at Avedon Hill by P.G. Holyfield. If you go to Murder at Avedon, A-V-E-D-O-N, Hill.com. I had a small role in the Metamore City podcast. I don't know if that's run yet. This may be down the road. I don't remember when it ran. It was just a really small bit part. But if you go to Metamore, M-E-T-A-M-O-R, city.com, you can find me there. And I just keep popping up. So I'm having a lot of fun being a voiceover person. And I will soon be receiving payment for my first professional gig doing a voiceover. So I'm getting excited. Things are coming up. And hey, if you want a professional voiceover artist for free for your podcast, podcast novel, or audio drama, send me an email at indianajim.podcast@gmail.com. Shameless plug. As far as 2007 goes, it was a mild success. I really can't complain, per se. I have a lot of contacts. I've met, networked with some very, very cool people. I have met in person Nathan Butler, Rich Siegfried. I've met Peter Schweighofer, Robert Buettner, and these are Con Carolina people I've met in person. I met Stuart Jaffe, Sherilyn Lambeth, what's the future in you? Stephen Ewan Cobb. I've just met some really cool people. And made friends online with people like Dickie of the Stealth Geek, Doug Rapson of Geek Acres, Jack Hosley of Wander Radio, Christiana Ellis, T. Morris, Scott Sigler a little bit. Who am I missing? Phil Rossi. And just a lot of cool people. So 2007 has been fun. I wish I had some more listeners, but slowly but surely we will get there. And I think as I get out of the topical radio show thing and move into more project audio like I talked about, we may see that begin to pick up. The website's going to be revamped, and I don't know. We'll see what happens. But here's to a successful 2008, and I want to thank all of you for supporting Things Are Looking Up through this last year. And golly, I just want to give you all a great big hug. But the last thing I'm going to leave you with, if you will recall, J.R.R. Tolkien developed Elvish from among many sources, but primarily the language of Finnish, which I realized after discovering Nightwish. And it rang a bell, ding, 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 because I heard this song that I'm about to play for you, not the whole thing, but a snippet, and it reminded me so much of Elvish that it just clicked that this was the base for Elvish. That Tolkien indeed did study the Finnish language, that he fell in love with the Finnish language, among many others, and used it to develop Elvish. And also, the band members love The Lord of the Rings, and I think a lot of that has to do with the Norse mythology that Tolkien drew on with Beowulf. What Tolkien was impressed with was the Kalevala, which is an epic poem that only exists in oral form. And there is one living person who knows the whole thing by heart, and he's like 100 years old. It's really interesting. If you bought the box set of Fellowship of the Ring Extended Edition with the Argonath statues, it came with a National Geographic Lord of the Rings DVD. I believe it's on there. If not, just look up Kalevala, K-A-L-E-V-A-L-A. Anyway, point is, listen to this. We're going to go out on this. Have a wonderful 2008. But we're going to experience it together. So, great. Anyway, have a good one. And we'll see you on the other side, as they say. Sain en pidä. Evanescence can most certainly not do that.